Okay, so what I want to talk about today is how one derives these anisotropic averaged Euler equations by a process that's different from Eulerian averaging. This is not the Reynolds averaging you might be accustomed to. This is Lagrangian averaging. And the point of view I start with is that, let me remind you about the Euler equations, and we'll take it from there. So Jerry did a lot of this. I won't have to repeat a lot. But the basic premise is for Euler is that I define a Lagrangian, which is a function of the velocity field, 1/2 the integral over my domain, u squared dx. Then I crank the calculus of variations machinery, however you want to do it, and out pop the Euler equations. And the key here is that the Lagrangian's kinetic energy. And the flow I'll define again as Jerry did. So this is the Eulerian or spatial velocity field, and I'll define the flow. The Lagrangian flow is satisfying the equation partial t of eta of t comma x is u of t comma eta of t comma x. And I'm going to think of this eta here as a sort of a microscopic flow map. So the basic picture is that I have my fluid domain omega, and I have my label here x, and this flow map,
oops, they're going to love me for this. And this flow map eta is going to take this label, which is sitting here at time zero, and this eta sub t, so I'll let eta sub t of x just be this flow eta of t comma x. This is going to tell you where this particle, where this label is going to go at time t in the fluid container. And the point of view I want to take is that this is a microscopic description, that it's probably not a great idea to think of this as giving you so much information that you're going to know exactly where this point is going to go. Instead of going to exactly this point, what I want to do is sort of fuzzy up this Lagrangian flow. I want to fuzzy it up by some perturbations. So what I'm going to think of is basically having an ensemble of perturbations. They're not going to be vector fields, an ensemble of maps which are going to perturb this microscopic description of where this label x is going to go. So let me make this a little bit bigger so I have room to blob it up. So I'm going to consider a little blob around here, maybe of diameter alpha or something. So I'm introducing a length scale into the problem. And now I'm going to introduce a two-parameter family of maps. Now, I'll tell you why I introduced this two-parameter family of maps in such a way. It's because I'm not going to do it stochastically first. I'm going to do it deterministically at first. And later I'll talk about the stochastic counterpart. But I'm going to introduce these fluctuation maps. So they're two-parameter family of maps. Epsilon is like a radial parameter. Theta is like an angular parameter. I'll explain that in a minute. And I'll call these maps xi, epsilon, super epsilon, theta, and it can also depend on time. So the picture that I have in mind here is that epsilon is going to run from, say, minus alpha over 2 to alpha over 2, and theta is going to be the angular variable. And this is radial. So the picture I have in mind here is that I go over to my microscopic flow, eta t of x, and then this takes me to my perturbed location. And epsilon is this radial distance that I'm flowing in as I perturb, and I can think of sort of this angle here as being theta. And this point here I'm going to call eta epsilon comma theta sub t, and it's going to be first I go to this point eta sub t, and then I flow backwards by this map xi epsilon theta. So it's a two-parameter family. I can flow for a certain amount of time epsilon, and I can go in various directions theta. Yeah, so right now I'm taking these to be smooth, volume-preserving maps. But later, I'd really like to think of these as Brownian motions on volume-preserving diffeomorphism group. And I'll indicate later how that changes the model. But for now, we can think of these as being smooth. So I have this basic Lagrangian decomposition. So the Lagrangian decomposition is a decomposition of mappings, which tells me that my new fuzzy flow, I'll call this the fuzzy flow, eta epsilon theta sub t of x is equal to xi epsilon theta inverse sub t composed with eta sub t of x. So this is the microscopic flow. This is the perturbation or fluctuation field. And this is the fuzzy flow. So it's... Sorry? My motivation for doing this thing is that I want to define the Eulerian variables associated with fuzzy flow, form a kinetic energy. Is there any change in the kinetic? Yes. Yes. And I'll show that through a sort of mixed Eulerian Lagrangian decomposition. Well, you know, let me just say it this way. You can think of it that way if you like. If you're more comfortable with a more traditional framework, think of this Lagrangian as being u of t, comma, eta of t, comma, x, u of t, comma, eta of t, comma, x, dx, dt. So here's the usual Euler kinetic energy Lagrangian. Now just take usual variations in eta. When you integrate by parts, you get the Euler equation. Because u has to be divergence free, you get the gradient, the pressure constraint. By characteristics, if you like.
No, these are not parameterizing variations. This is really fuzzing up our brain. Different. Just let them go on. You see,
they're equals of finite.
No, let me just make one comment real quick. So first, when I write this down, this is still in the Euler context. No fuzzing up. I'm just explaining the process of taking a variation using sort of more standard Euler Lagrange techniques. Yeah, go ahead, Adrian.
Actually, if I understand what you were saying, when we see these kind of trajectories, the trajectories, in fact, we label them at the moment, eta epsilon theta sub t, and then we label them at the reward that you see in your eyes. Now he's going to look for average flow in the for a theta. And now he's assuming that there is some transformation, if you want this transformation, from the average flow that he's going to look for and the reality that he's watching. Now that's what he's going to decide.
Well, let me just make one comment. So what you say is true. That's right. I just want to make one comment here. One can do the Euler-Poincaré machinery with a spatial velocity fields. One can do the sort of usual variational principle the way you might do it this way, simply by letting U be a divergence-free vector field, taking variations in the particle displacement fields, and then integrating by parts, and you get the usual Euler equation. So Peter's question initially was, how am I going to take the variations here? I'm saying think of it, do it either using a Euler-Poincaré machinery or using the usual Euler-Lagrange machinery, whatever you like. That's not to be confused with this operation here. What I'm doing here is now sort of the way Idris said it. Here I have a microscopic description of the flow, and I'm saying that's too much to hope for in the real world. In the real world, we only know where we're going to end up with some error bounds. And I'm putting error bounds of diameter alpha, and I'm saying that, in fact, this particle here, label here can really go anywhere inside this object here. And it's going to be fuzzied up by these fluctuation maps. Ultimately, you can think of these fluctuation maps as Brownian motions about the microscopic description. Yes? Well, you see, epsilon. Think of epsilon as a microscopic time. It's a very short amount of time because you're thinking that the error bounds you're putting on this alpha is a small sized blob. Okay, so these are volume preserving. Yes. Yes. So the the sort of fuzzy flow has all the properties of the microscopic flow at this point, including smoothness. Okay. Now let me continue. Yes.
If so, I'm
No, at this stage they're deterministic. Later I will make a comment as to what happens when I let these actually be Brownian motions. Yeah. Okay, so the point here is I have a Lagrangian decomposition. Now I want to make the corresponding decomposition in terms of the Eulerian variables. So let me define the Eulerian variables. So the Eulerian variables corresponding to this, well, I already know that partial t eta of t comma x is equal to u of t comma eta of t comma x. And now I want to define partial t eta epsilon comma theta of t comma x to be u epsilon comma theta of t comma eta epsilon theta of tx. And finally, I want to define the Eulerian variable corresponding to these fluctuation maps. So I'll call this w. So this will be partial xi, partial t xi epsilon theta of t comma x is equal to w epsilon theta of t xi epsilon theta of t comma x. So these are the flow maps I introduced, the microscopic, the fuzzy, and the fluctuation, and these are the Eulerian variables. This is the sort of microscopic velocity field due to Euler, Navier, Stokes. This is the velocity field due to the fuzzing up of the flow, and this is the fluctuation velocity field. And now the question is, what is the decomposition in terms of these variables? And to find that out, one simply needs to differentiate this decomposition in time. Easy enough. So we do that. And we find this sort of mixed Eulerian-Lagrangian decomposition, which says that u epsilon theta of t comma x is equal to the derivative of xi epsilon theta inverse sub t acting on the vector u minus w epsilon theta composed with xi epsilon theta of t comma x. So you see this part here, you might expect, I sort of identify this with the usual Reynolds decomposition into mean and fluctuating parts, if you like. This is sort of the Eulerian part, but you see, doing the decomposition on the Lagrangian variables and then asking what the decomposition is in terms of the Eulerian variables leads to this mixed decomposition. So this is the matrix of partial derivatives of this inverse map. This is the vector, and then you just compose it with this map. So this is the Eulerian part, and this here is the Lagrangian part. Okay. The idea now is to substitute, say, fluids is governed by kinetic energy. Inviscid fluids is governed by kinetic energy. Let's use the kinetic energy of this fluid field and then average over the radial and angular variables to obtain an averaged model. So I can define this averaged Lagrangian. I'll call it L super alpha because I've introduced a length scale into the problem. This will be the one half the integral over the fluid domain. Now I'll integrate from in the radial direction. So this will be the integral from minus alpha over 2 to alpha over 2. I'll normalize by 1 over alpha. Then I'll integrate over the radial, the angular variable, and I'll just take the kinetic energy. D epsilon, d theta, dx. So there I have an average Lagrangian. And now the game I'm going to play is to take Taylor expansions about this. So here I should note that when epsilon is equal to 0, xi 0 theta is equal to the identity because you're flowing for time 0. So when xi is equal to, when epsilon is equal to 0, these are just the identity map and you recover the microscopic flow field. And what I want to define here is, because in this description I would... Say again? So let me define the infinitesimal fluctuation vector, because this is all I really want to use for this model. It would be too much to hope for to know the full sort of map, nonlinear map. So let me define this to be xi prime. This is a function of theta, of time, and of space. This is dd epsilon at epsilon equals 0, xi epsilon theta of t comma x. So this is the, I think, what you were just talking about. So what this picture is right here, this is just the linearization of this flow map. It's this vector right here, xi prime, and it's parameterized by theta. Now I'm going to make an assumption. So there's one assumption in this theory, and this is going to serve as a corrector in homogenization theory, which I'll explain later. So we'll call this the Taylor hypothesis, following Taylor and Darrell. And this hypothesis is simply saying that this object here, as a covector, as a one-form, is frozen into the fluid the way density is frozen into the fluid, or the way vorticity is frozen into the fluid in two dimensions. Hypothesis. So this says that partial t of xi prime, I should put a little flat here to remind you that it really should be as a one-form, plus the lead derivative of xi prime is equal to 0. In coordinates, this is just saying that if xi prime is the sum from I equals 1 to 3 or 1 to 2 of xi d dxi, in other words, if xi are the coordinates of this object, then this Taylor hypothesis is just saying that partial t of xi plus xi comma j uj plus uj comma I xi j is equal to 0. No. No. I mean, all you see, the thing about the constraint Jerry was talking about is pretty simple. You see, the picture is when you do the calculus of variations, what you have to take variations of really is not the velocity field, but the particle displacement field. And the constraints Jerry was talking about is when you take variations of the particle displacement field, how does that translate into a variation of the spatial velocity field? And it just happens to take this form. This is related because of this Lie-advection operator, but it has nothing to do with constraints. Yes, that's right. It's related to the deviation from the microscopic flow field, but it has nothing to do with the constraints Jerry was talking about for the calculus of variations. No. I mean, this assumption is basically saying that to first order in alpha, the infinitesimal fluctuation, the sort of linearization of the fluctuation, is being carried by the fluid like a stick in a river. And this is sort of following what Taylor's thinking. This is the sort of thinking Darrell had in mind, and I think it's a very reasonable thing. We don't know what's happening in turbulence, but this is a relatively mild assumption to make to that leading order. And that's all it is. And what we'll see is that this comes back. We're going to have a model that a PDE which we can solve for length scales down to order alpha, and this is actually going to serve as like as a corrector, which will actually be able to improve that. So let me continue. And one can calculate this quantity by doing DNS.
No.
Let me continue, and the picture will become a little bit clearer once it's unified. This is already, well, you see, this xi prime has eliminated alpha from the problem. It's taken the derivative with respect to the radial variable. So in some sense, it already has been Taylor expanded. It's the first term in the Taylor expansion. So let me continue. This is either 0 or not 0? Think of it this way. At time zero, you know what the microscopic and macroscopic descriptions of your fluid motion are. No. Exactly. That's exactly what it's saying. And the point I'm trying to make is...
side of the equation, it starts depending on the velocity of the polymer.
Right here? This right here? This right here?
Yeah.
It depends on theta, t, and x. It comes from differentiating these fluctuation maps. It comes from differentiating this family of fluctuation maps. So it's defined right here. So in some sense, you can think of at time zero, you know the difference between the mean and the actual solution. And that difference is going to be carried by the flow. Yes? If you allow me to continue, I'll try and make a comment on all the various comments that are being made. I'll try and answer some of your questions. No, I like the interaction, but I think that I don't want to run out of time before I get to the punchline. Okay, so where am I? Right. Now, what I want to do here is that using this assumption, I want to now take Wienand's suggestion and Taylor expand this velocity field in epsilon about epsilon equal to zero. So I'm going to expand u epsilon theta of t comma x about epsilon equal to zero, and just note that when epsilon is equal to zero, I recover simply u, the microscopic flow. This is because these are the identities, and w is equal to zero when epsilon is equal to zero because I have to differentiate the identity in time. So when I do this expansion, I get the following, that u epsilon theta of t comma x is equal to u of t comma x plus 2 epsilon, the rate of deformation tensor of u acting on xi prime of theta, t, and x, plus order epsilon squared. And what I propose to do now is to substitute this velocity field into my average Lagrangian. It's truncated now to order epsilon squared. I propose to substitute it in here, average, and define an average Lagrangian up to that order of expansion. Now, in theory, I could define it to any orders of expansion by keeping more terms in the Taylor expansion. This will be the first order correction to the Euler equation. So we'll see that the Euler equation is, and Navier-Stokes serves as sort of the zeroth order model in this system. One can view this in two philosophically different ways. You can think of these xi epsilon thetas as actually telling you the microstructure of the fluid, and that for the Euler-Navier-Stokes problem, the microstructure is being smeared out. Whereas in this problem, you're keeping that information intact. Or you can take the point of view that Euler-Navier-Stokes are the microscopic description, and you're forming a macroscopic description with these as being, with these maps being fluctuations rather than microstructure. Both philosophies are valid, I believe. Do I have more? No. I'm sorry? Yeah. So this is the order epsilon term. This is the order epsilon squared term. Okay, now I just... Okay, so now what happens is when I substitute this into this average Lagrangian, I define the first order average Lagrangian. So I'll call this L alpha sub 1. This is going to be a function of u and this fluctuation tensor F. So I'll tell you what F is. F is going to be a matrix, Fij. It's going to be the integral. It's a function of t and x. It's the integral over the angular variables of xi of theta t comma x, xj of theta of t comma x, d theta. So you can think of this. It turns out that when one takes the stochastic point of view and lets this family be Brownian motions, this turns out to be exactly the covariance tensor, the correlation between the various components of the infinitesimal fluctuation maps. In this deterministic picture, you can think of it as a little ellipsoid with anisotropy, where in each direction you're measuring the variation or deviation away from the microscopic flow. Now what you get here is 1/2 the integral over your fluid container, u of x squared plus 2 alpha squared, this matrix F acting on def u, acting on def u dx. Xi prime? Xi prime doesn't have to be small. If I multiply
by alpha.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that kills the order alpha terms, you see, is this integral from minus alpha over 2 to alpha over 2. Yeah, so this gradient's coming from just expanding this. What do you mean by rescale the labels? That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the averaging is really occurring inside here. That's right. Yeah.
Tell me a nice story about what happens between the cross term of the u and the order epsilon squared.
Yeah, I mean, this appears that it adds to the order epsilon squared dynamics. In fact, it doesn't, because just as one has specified the dynamics, it turns out when you expand this order epsilon squared term really has xi double prime, two derivatives of this map xi epsilon theta. That has its own dynamics, and it turns out to make what appears a priori appears to be an order epsilon squared term to be order epsilon cubed. You know, I don't want to go into such boring details, but in fact this really does come out. And what happens now is that, yes? Change in the volume? Where do you, all the transformation? All the transformations I've made, I've assumed this is a. Yes, but you see only thing I've assumed is that xi epsilon theta, the original unexpanded map, is volume preserving. Yes. So no, but there is no, what I'm saying is there is no additional, there's no Jacobian transformation that pops up here. No, let me just make a comment. You see, the starting point was that I assumed that the Lagrangian was this form. Now you're asking, why did I assume this? Yes. Because I didn't use the volume preserving transformation, I only used its infinitesimal linearization. That's why I didn't use the full map. I used only its linearization, its derivative. It won't be volume preserving anymore. If it's small, yeah. No, I was very careful not to do that anywhere. In fact, the second order terms I'm retaining are not of the volume preserving map. They're of the vector field, which is the linearization of that map flow field. That's quite different.
You have to argue why those second order terms are used to retain the other counting drop.
Well, because it's in principle, you're assuming that you can make a Taylor expansion so that the higher order in the expansion you go, the closer you come to retaining the full. Well, I claim actually that, you see, this expansion comes based on this assumption. This assumption is already using making some assumptions about the flow, you see, and I think that's what Peter's talking about. Now, the second assumption is what's happening on the higher order derivatives of this volume preserving map, and I think that's where, right, I think that's exactly where the questions of the physics come in. But let me continue and talk about this as a PDE now. So now, again, one has this Lagrangian. You take variations in U and F. You just crank the calculus of variations machinery, and you get a coupled system of equations now, one for the flow field U and one for this fluctuation tensor F. So what you get is the following. First, you have to define an elasticity operator. So you see what happened. I wrote this in Euclidean space. In Euclidean space, what you have to define is this fourth rank tensor C, which is going to be the symmetrization of delta, the Dirac delta function, tensor F. In other words, Kronecker delta, sorry. This is a symmetric matrix. This is a symmetric matrix, and you want a fourth rank tensor, and you just completely symmetrize this. And now you define an elasticity-like operator, which I'll call script C, which is just the divergence of this fourth rank tensor C acting on Nabla U. With this definition, you can define the following system of equations. These are the anisotropic, averaged, Euler, blah, blah, blah. So you get partial T, 1 minus alpha squared C U, plus U dot grad 1 minus alpha squared partial C U, plus Nabla U transpose. This transposes as a matrix acting on 1 minus alpha squared C U. And then there's these correction terms that come in. You get plus 2 alpha squared F contracted. So this is a matrix with two components. It's being contracted with a third rank tensor, which is the gradient of the rate of deformation or the strain tensor squared, minus 4 alpha squared, the divergence of F acting on the rate of deformation squared, is equal to minus the gradient of the pressure. Of course, you have the incompressibility condition, div U is equal to 0. Some initial data, U of 0 is equal to U naught. Boundary conditions, U equals 0 on partial omega. And now you have to couple this, I'll call this A, you have to couple this with the fact that this fluctuation tensor is also frozen into the macroscopic flow. So partial T F, I'll just write it as plus lead derivative of F in the direction U. This literally means that F is just frozen into the macroscopic flow field. So you see what's happening is that as you're solving for U, you have to invert an elliptic operator which has this elasticity tensor built up from this fluctuation tensor. The fluctuation tensor itself is being frozen into the fluid, so it's changing, it's stretching, and so forth. So they feed back into one another. And again, you assign initial conditions. F at time 0 is equal to F naught. Now, what happens is, let me just say, make a remark, and then I'll comment on some of the analytic features here, is that when you solve this system, you get the pair U and F. And you can see here that U is just the zeroth order term in this asymptotic expansion. And now I can go back and I can correct for this. You can think of this as a sophisticated LES model, if you like. You get the zeroth order term. But now I can go back and use this Taylor hypothesis. I can use this as a corrector. I know U. I solve a sequence. I discretize in theta, say, at every degree or something. I solve a simple linear advection problem. And now I can go back and I can correct up to order epsilon, which is a nice feature. So you get the solution for U and F, and then you use this equation here, star, to correct. And this gives you U alpha theta is equal to U plus alpha def U dot xi prime up to order alpha squared. So in theory, you can think of this as a model sort of like the usual alpha model, which is filtering out at scales smaller than alpha, but then you have this mechanism to go in and correct for scales that you actually haven't solved for very accurately. So this is really like a sort of the analog of a cell problem in homogenization theory, except for the cell problem arises mathematically, and here it's arising as a hypothesis. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about certain analytic results about this model. Again, if you take either point of view, either the sort of geometric point of view or the characteristic point of view, you see again that this equation only has one derivative in this 1 minus alpha squared cu term. So along characteristics, it's again going to have no derivative loss. But having no derivative loss isn't exactly the issue for well-posedness. So let me say what's really happening in the Euler case, and then I'll talk about what's happening in the isotropic case. If I have a minute or two, I'll say something about vortex methods, limits of zero viscosity. There's actually very interesting connections with the limits of zero viscosity with some of the stuff that you did with Wu. In fact, it turns out, this is work with Marcel Oliver that I'm just mentioning, that it seems that Navier-Stokes, for very weak data, Navier-Stokes converges faster to the averaged Euler equation than it does to Euler itself. Sorry? Yeah, so it's slightly different than the point of view you took with Wu, but it's sort of, it's in principle the same thing, yeah. So what's happening with, let me just remind you about well-posedness for Euler. So I'm going to rewrite this equation along characteristics, as if you like. I have 3 minutes? Okay, let me take 1 minute to do this then. I have 3 minutes, I'm not sure. Okay, so I can write this as eta double dot is equal to minus grad p composed with eta. And what is the gradient of the pressure? The pressure comes from solving a Neumann problem. So I can write this as minus the gradient Laplacian inverse divergence of Nabla UU composed with eta. As you noted in your paper, and as Jerry noted in, or a long time ago with his paper as Eben, because of the divergence-free constraint, this really turns into just the trace of Nabla U dot Nabla U. So the incompressibility is crucial here to prevent derivative loss. So you see, if you're in a smooth enough class of functions where you have a multiplicative algebra, this is an HS minus products in HS minus 1, you get two derivatives back, you lose one, you're still in HS. That's not the big deal here. The way you get well-posedness is, in fact, rather tricky because you see the map that takes eta to eta inverse as a map of HS into HS is only C0. Yet, it turns out that this operator here, when you think of this as a vector field mapping eta and eta dot, some really nice stuff happens, and this turns out to be C infinity. So it has nothing to do with the fact, well, it has a little to do with the fact that there's zero derivative loss along characteristics. The real magic is why when this map, going from eta to eta inverse is only C0, not even locally Lipschitz, do you get a smooth vector field here. But look. You have to invert the map, because if you're doing it in the PD context, you're doing it in terms of U.
Yeah.
But U is eta dot composed with eta inverse. But if you do it in Eulerian coordinates, you can't get the C infinity result. No. I'm saying. Yeah. That's right. You see, I mean, you can see where it's lost right here, Peter. It's because this map is only C0. That's why this only becomes C0. So the point is, why I wanted to do this is that, in fact, when you do this, when you change the Lagrangian from kinetic energy to either the H1 case, where you don't have the fluctuation tensor, or with the fluctuation tensor, you get equations that have at most one derivative on the highest order term. And along characteristics, that roughly speaking, takes a form like this. So, well, you can write this as a system, of course, where...
No, I mean, the result, the kind of result that you get, for instance, using the Eulerian method, you get from C1 alpha.
Well, that's what you did in your recent paper, but that wasn't done beforehand.
No.
And that's not a classic Eulerian method either. Well, it's sort of Eulerian, but you're using the fact that the inverse label map is frozen into the fluid. Yeah, so you're using, in fact, some Lagrangian information. So the point is that Lagrangian information is crucial to getting really nice results. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Absolutely. No, actually, I think...